back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively, into a political season here. We're going to take a moment away from what's going on in Europe here to talk about some things going on in Baltimore. Don Mahler joins us here. One thing going on in Baltimore next week, we're going to be renewing the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery. I'm going to be over at Mama's on the Half Shell. Crab cakes every Friday through the spring, and then in May, we're going to be branching out all over the city and all over the community. Don, I haven't had a crab cake this year, and I'm hoping that when this guy's fancy TV project all takes place, that maybe I'll have a crab cake with him and some of the other folks. But we were bringing on all sorts of serious journalists here, so this one's going to be a great one. It's been a busy afternoon here.
Today is Journalism Day. We've had some of Maryland's best, and we're excited to have coming back to join us again. Formerly of the Baltimore Sun, doing great work there, primarily on the crime beat. Now heading along with so many others over to the Baltimore Banner that have so many of us excited. And we will be talking about his upcoming HBO project, We Own This City. We welcome back Justin Fenton. Justin, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, some folks say We Own This City upcoming project. Like, no. I read the book last summer, and we had last year at the other paper and like all of that. This has really turned into something. I mean, I know the last time we had you on, it was like happening and rumored to be happening and all of that. But just bring us up to speed, not just on the Banner thing, but on this television show that's a 6-episode series that I think anyone that read the book or even came in contact or read the Cliff Notes will probably want to check this out. And this must be exciting for you to have this turn into something visual, right?
I mean, it's surreal. I mean, it's not something I ever thought was going to happen. When I started the book, it was always contemplated that there would be a show made by David Simon and George Pelicanos and Ed Burns, who did The Wire and other great shows. But it took some time. I got the book out. We were working on this show and writing it. I was part of the writer's room, which is an amazing opportunity. And then, they started filming it last summer and wrapped up in November. And they just announced the air date. The air date is April 25th. It'll be on HBO and HBO Max. And I'm just real excited to see, for people to be able to see it. I got to see some filming myself, and it was great. But, I haven't seen a finished product, and I'm really, really eager.
Well, Justin, as you know, because we talked when the book came out, we had Bill Zorzi on, and I kidded Bill.
Very reluctant guest to like out of talking crap.
Great. Bill was great, and I said to him, I know I had to sell 50 books because everybody I ran into, I said, you have to read this book. Put a day or two aside because you won't be able to put it down. It was compelling. And for folks who are listening and aren't familiar with it, I guess what I'll ask you to do is give them sort of the Four Dummies summary. It's the sure. Baltimore Gun Trace Task Force, Wayne Jenkins and the boys. Give folks sort of a summary of what they're about to see on We Own This City when they turn HBO on.
Yeah, so the book is focused on the Gun Trace Task Force scandal. It was a group of plainclothes officers who were sent out on the streets to try to do proactive policing and get guns off the street. But really, these guys were abusing the discretion that they had to rob people and steal money, steal drugs, arrest people search them without probable cause. But really, the book tries to take a long view of it about the city's battle with crime. Basically a 15-year view starting around the O'Malley administration and the city's constant efforts to try to use the police to fight crime and the things that have happened along the way. Some of the warning signs, some of the scandals that cropped up but weren't really taken seriously. And that's what's important about this story going forward is like, how do we prevent this from happening again? Obviously, the police department is under a federal consent decree where a judge is mandating reforms. But, over the years, people have always said that they were trying to improve things and everything was always getting better. And really, there's a lot of stuff going on at the surface that they weren't willing to talk about or weren't even aware of, really. I mean, you can't say that they knew about it per se. I think that it's very important that we don't let history repeat itself.
Well, Justin, when you say we can't let history repeat itself, this was clearly a topic that you knew, I mean, inside and out. I mean, you really dove into this topic. And I'll come back. Some of this we covered before, but I think it's important to revisit it for folks. And the question we asked Bill this, and I won't tell you his answer, but I'll ask you the same thing again. After living it through the book and now reliving it again through the HBO series, the question that Nestor continues to raise is, was it possible for all of this to happen and the higher ups truly not know anything about what was going on? That's the question that people always ask me. Where do you come down now after several years of looking at this?
I mean, I think the answer to that is that by its nature, people who are robbing people and stealing drugs and dealing drugs, they're not going to want people to know about that. You know, they keep a closed circle or they don't tell anybody. I think that's the just criminal nature. So to expect that people knew about that, I don't think that any evidence through all these different reviews and investigations and my own research has really shown that they knew that. I think what is really clear, though, is that they did know that these officers had problems. They had integrity problems. There was questions being raised. There's accusations being made. I think there's very much a lack of, people did not trust when someone who was arrested made a complaint. They said, oh, of course they're saying that. They're just saying that because they got arrested. But at a certain point, these things start to accumulate. And when you're dismissing them as one-offs and not looking at the bigger picture, you know, some of these officers weren't really well known to the public. Some of these officers, when they were arrested, it was the first time I'd ever heard their names. Others were extremely well known. I mean, there was the one officer, Daniel Herschel, who I wrote about a couple of weeks ago, is my last, one of my last stories for The Sun. I mean, everybody knew about his history. The Sun had written about him. It's been raised in numerous different ways, and they just kept throwing him back out there. And that circles back to that idea of, you know, the crime fight. It's all about the crime fight. And he was seen as someone who was working hard and getting results. If people had looked a little bit closer, they would have seen that they weren't quite getting those results. These cases didn't stand up in court. But from their perspective of this day in and day out fight against crime, you know, they perceived these officers to be effective and they wanted to keep that going.
Justin, the question for this is, how big was the circle? You know, how many people really knew about, did girlfriends know about, like, other than the actual drug dealers that are getting robbed, who I guess couldn't say we were getting robbed or whatever was happening with the crimes they were committing, primarily to criminals, correct? Right? They robbed criminals exclusively or primarily, right?
I would say primarily, but not exclusively. No, there's plenty of people who got caught up because they fit the profile. They were getting profiled. They were stopped because the police were fishing. That was one of the things that really I think was eye-opening for me, was this idea of, like, so oftentimes the police will hold a press conference and we'll see a court case where they got a gun. They pulled someone over and got a gun. But you really don't hear about the times where they pull people over and find nothing. And what I did was I asked for all the body camera footage. God bless body cameras. I mean, to be able to see all the people they pulled over for, you know, for being too far from the curb, from being, you know, at a gas pump without a seatbelt on. There's so many people got pulled over for not having a seatbelt on at a gas pump. You know, you're just getting yourself back into your car. You're getting situated. You're pulling. You're not even pulled out on the street. And you're getting pulled over for not having a seatbelt on.
And if that happened to the three of us as white dudes, like, we'd be like, "You're kidding me, right? Like, you've got to be kidding me."
This was a common tactic. They got him driving off of CVS parking lots, still on the property of a gas station, and searched and finding nothing. And that's the kind of stuff that people are, you know, when people say they're upset with the police, they're upset about that kind of stuff. They don't want to be treated that way. And the Gun Trace Task Force officers, you know, the ones who cooperated with the government, really spoke openly about these things. They told us, this is what we did. This is how we did it. You know, we pulled over as many people as we could because we knew at a certain point we're going to get lucky and hit on a gun. But to go back to your question about how many people knew, I think what I said before, I don't think it was good for business for these officers to let everybody know. But we've certainly seen examples where it's clear that officers, there was a wink and a nudge, you know, a wink and a nod and sort of, you know, looking the other way and things like that. I think people knew, even if they didn't know specifics. And I think they also, one of the things that's come out is sort of they surround themselves with like-minded officers. So if they got a hunch that somebody wasn't down with that or that they couldn't trust them, they sort of moved to get themselves away from those people. So in that sense, not everybody knew. But there was, I think, you know, smoke signals and things like that.
Well, there's a lot of stories, as well as officers coming out saying, I saw what that guy was doing. I turned him in and they threw me out, right? Like that was part of this as well, right?
Not that directly, but yeah. I mean, there was officers who were sort of not down with the program and got transferred and things like that. So to that extent, they don't know what's going on. They get moved away before they really find out about it. There's not a lot of whistleblower type stuff going on. The book does focus on, there's one officer, Ryan Gwynn, who brought suspicions to the deputy commissioner. He said, you know, I don't have a good feeling about this officer. I saw him hanging out with a guy that we're investigating as a drug dealer in this neighborhood. But did he have the goods to really have the officer fire or discipline that guy? Or maybe did he bring something to their attention that should have caused him to look deeper and they failed to do that? I think that's more of the situation.
And again, we're with Justin Fenton, longtime Baltimore Sun reporter, outstanding crime reporter, moving to the new Baltimore Banner, already at the Banner in his temporary office. And again, Nestor and I, our good friend, we always tip our hat to the gone too soon Ted Venatulwas and the Venatulwas Institute. Ted, one of the most important people in the region, and the Banner will be selling subscriptions soon. So if you believe in a robust free press, please be ready to subscribe to the Banner. Justin, one of the things that I was struck by when I read the book the first time, and it stood out to me, maybe this goes to what you're talking about again, that there should have been some warning signs, was that I think I've said before, I have a cousin that was like a brother to me that ended up as a major in the state police. I don't think he ever fired his gun. Most police officers that I've known, and I have a lot of close friends who are Baltimore County police officers, who come out very well in Justin Fenton's book, by the way.
He always points that out, Justin, just so you know.
Baltimore County Police Department.
It's like you ran the county or something.
Most of them have never, in their career, will never fire their gun. I want to say that Wayne Jenkins, I think he had more than 20 instances where he fired his gun, right? I mean, it was something crazy. He fired his gun.
No. I mean, the brutality stuff, there were some instances where he beat people up or things like that, mostly early in his career. I believe I can only think of one shooting he was involved with.
Okay.
He didn't fire his weapon. And he bear hugged somebody and other officers fired once they said they saw a gun.
But, well, yeah. I asked you this. Okay, I'm sorry, I misremembered it. I asked you this before. Now that you've studied and lived this Jenkins character for a number of years, what was it that allowed him to have the hold on these other officers that he did? What's the magnetism of Wayne Jenkins?
He was described as a cowboy, as someone who, you know, went out on the streets and was fearless. Car crashes, car chases, you know, effective at getting guns. He was very brash in the sense that he made sure everybody in the department knew how good he was. He sent out these daily emails so that the whole department would know that they got guns. When he was challenged, he pushed back. You know, he was investigated by internal affairs and they brought charges against him in a case where someone said drugs were planted. And when he finally beat the case, he sent this defiant email like back to internal affairs saying like, how dare you? And, you know, how dare you do that to me and things like that. So he and this was not someone who was sort of, you know, flying under the radar or lurking in the shadows. This is somebody who's very in your face. And I think that was by design to try to, you know, like, so people wouldn't suspect him because he's someone who's so out there, proactive in maintaining his reputation. I think that was all by design.
Justin, I would say you go ahead, Don.
I'm just going to say any remorse on Jenkins's part down the road as you followed up, as you sort of kept track of him, any regrets on his part?
Well, I'm sure he's full of regrets. He's serving a long term in prison, but as far, you know, he really tried to maintain, and I think continues to try to maintain, that he's not guilty of all the things he's accused of. I think at first he said it was all made up, and then he started to say, I did some of these things, but not all. He did a radio interview, a podcast interview with the BBC, actually, from prison, where he admitted some things. And I think there was a review recently, an outside review by Michael Bromwich, the former inspector general of the Justice Department. And he did a review of this case, took years, cost the city like $5 million. And, you know, he tried to talk to Jenkins, and Jenkins had all these demands. You know, he wanted it to be on his terms. And they basically talked to him for a brief time and told him, forget it. So, I mean, you know, that I think that kind of gives a window into his current mindset.
Justin, making a film out of this or making a dramatization out of it, I mean, I think it's one thing for a journalist like you to say, all right, we're going to do a documentary and we're just going to go with the facts and we have pictures and we have evidence and we have, you know, people we could sit down and talk to about and piecing the story together. I love that stuff. But this is different. This is David getting involved in this. I have never seen The Wire. I've admitted that already to Bill Zorzi once this week, but talk me into seeing this because I'm going to commit the 6 hours to doing it just because I'm so fascinated by your book and the story. But in putting this together as a dramatization, where do we meet Wayne Jenkins in your story? You know what I mean? Is this first time out where he roughs up the first person and I'm trying to get a hold of how you turn this incredibly heinous story into television, because I'm sure you are unfamiliar with this as well.
Yeah, no, it was very interesting to observe the process. I was there mostly as a consultant to sort of try to throw out real life events that happened, try to make sure things were based in real people and real events. What's my pitch for why you should watch it? I mean, again, these are talented storytellers. They've done so many amazing shows, you know, Show Me a Hero and The Deuce and The Plot Against America. I think, you know, The Wire, showed people, the drug war and the different ways people experience the criminal justice system and how this city, was run. It was based on events that were true from the writer's experiences, but ultimately fiction. This story's real. You know, this story really happened. And we have actors that are going to portray those real people and tell that story. There's other people who are sort of symbols of other, you know, there's a character who's an investigator from the Department of Justice, and she comes here trying to understand how these things happen. So through her, you know, she interviews people, residents, police officers, trying to understand how we got here and how we can get out of it. And so I just think, I think based on a true story is a good way to tell it. So we can recreate some of these things that we don't have camera footage for, or we weren't there for, that we can't tell through a documentary. But instead with these great actors like Josh Charles, who's from Baltimore, and John Bernthal, who's amazing and seems like he's in everything these days. So I hope people learn something.
How much of it do you know what was said from witnesses and saying, this is the way this went down in an alley or wherever these incidents of crime happened, to know what Wayne Jenkins might have actually said? You know, we're not making reality TV here, but just trying to put yourself, because I'm sure in writing the book and through all this, you're getting real quotes as a reporter would, right, and then trying to piece the rest of it together as to how the hell they got away with this. Because that really is the story. I mean, that's the thing that Don and I are like, how the hell did this happen? I'm sure the TV part of this is trying to explain how it happened.
Yeah, I mean, for the book, for sure, there's no quotes that weren't actually said by somebody. And so I relied on court documents, videos of court hearings, you know, body camera videos, all reports. There's wiretaps from when the FBI was investigating where we can actually there's real time conversations, including conversations that didn't get released to the public. So for this, the dialogue, there's definitely some moments in the show that are directly as they happened. And that was surreal to watch, you know, watching actors say dialogue that in fact is the real dialogue. But of course, there's many other things where it is our best guess of what might have been said, or trying to, you know, portray that moment that we know happened, but we don't have the actual, you know, we weren't there. There wasn't cameras rolling. So, you know, it's a mix of that.
You've never talked to Jenkins in your life. Is that fair to say? Is that correct or incorrect?
I have not talked to him. There was a time where he wanted to speak to me. He sent me a package via his wife. And it was a video that he said would show that the claims against him were not true. It was a video where someone had a press conference and said, the gun was planted on me. And he sent me body camera footage that definitively shows that that gun was not planted on that guy, that you can see it. It was not planted. He admitted to it. And so but again, in Jenkins' warped world, he's thinking, well, just this one guy's lying, so everybody else is lying, which isn't true. We know that many of the other things happened beyond a reasonable doubt. And then, as they said, if you write this, he'll talk to you. And I wanted to write it anyway. I thought it was fair. I thought it was fair to show that not every claim was true. This fog of how do we know the next time this happens, who's telling the truth and who's not, that there's different incentives for people to perhaps, you know, now that this has come to light, sort of come to the table with all sorts of claims. So I wrote it because I wanted to write it regardless. And he must not have liked it, or maybe he got what he needed out of me and he did not speak to me. Then I think they approached me. He had a friend he served time with who's out now, who was trying to coordinate interviews. And at a certain point I felt, and I don't know what, other than the sheer curiosity of speaking with him, it didn't seem like he was willing to really own up to things and be honest. And he had an agenda. And I really was sort of like, I don't know what the point of this is. So I have not pushed it.
Right, what else am I going to get out of that? Again, we're with Justin Fenton, author of We Own This City, coming to HBO and HBO Max on April the 25th. Justin, I know over the years I've read and followed authors whose books end up on the big screen or on HBO. Some like the adaptation, some don't. You happy with the 6 episodes as they come out and as it captures your book?
I haven't seen them yet, but again, I've seen those scripts and I saw some of the filming, and yeah, I'm excited for people to see it.
When are you going to see it, man? I mean, like, this is, I'm asking you about it. You're like, you know, I've seen little parts of it and it's your baby, right? Like, and you're not really in control. You're just going to watch it and that's it, whatever it is, it is. And this, but when do you get to sit in a suite? Did they invite you to New York? Do you get champagne? What happens, man?
No, I'm not disavowing the project. It really is David Simon and George Pelikan. It's their baby. You know, they're up in New York City editing it. I'm lucky to be involved in some way, but that's, you know, it's their project that I got to.
Well, Simon was out drunk the other night, pissed off that it had to go down to 58 and a half minutes from 61. I remember that. And you tell him, and I told Zorzi this, I collected this book of maledicta back in the 90s, which is ways to insult people across centuries with all sorts of really heinous insults in every language imaginable, translated to English. And I want to give that to David as a gift for his Twitter use. So let him know that.
He will definitely get a lot of use out of that. But no, and honestly, I am at the Baltimore Banner. We're not up yet, not up and running, but we're working very hard. There's a lot of work to be done. So, you know, while I'm very excited about the show and can't wait for it to come out, we are doing some very interesting things here, trying to get set up for our launch in a few months.
And you're busy writing the next book.
I promise to let you talk about the Banner at length here. Before we do that, though, one of the – be malpractice if we don't do this – so many tragic characters in We Own This City. One that I continue to think about, and you and I and Nestor have spoken about before, is Sean Souter. Again, is Souter, is he just damaged? But I mean, is he just along for the ride at the end? Is he just a tragic figure that gets drawn into this and we're not sure if he killed himself or not. I mean, what's your take after all this about Sean Souter?
You know, I think I have a take. I also think that, you know, it's hard to be definitive about something like this. I think we don't know what we don't know. We know what the evidence suggests. I would say that I was in a documentary that also aired on HBO. It was directed by Sonia Sohn, who played Kima on The Wire. And it was a documentary about the Souter case and the intersections to the Gun Trace Task Force. I think that documentary had a certain take on the case, and I think the limited series, the scripted series, will have a take. I think my take is my book, which is I lay out sort of the information that's available. It is a controversial case, and some very strong opinions. But yeah, I think that it's going to. I'm not punting on your question. I just
no. Let me ask it this way. Let me ask it another way.
Do you wake up every day thinking something different, or are you definitive in what you think of it?
I think there's some things I'd still like to have answers to, but I also feel as though, based on what we know now, I mean, I think there's a. It's unfortunate that it's going to be classified as this open homicide probably forever. I think the department is doing that just to sort of not wade in and have to take a position. But I think, you know, there's so many things in this book and this story that didn't come to light for years. And I just wonder, you know, if something years from now might come out related to this case. But I think based on what we know now, I think there's some conclusions to be drawn. And I think that they do suggest that he likely took his own life, but I don't want to be definitive about something so serious.
You know, Justin, your response there, I think, is so consistent. And I've spoken to other reporters who have dived into this case, the Souter case, in some detail. And I think your description is really apt in that most of them will say to me, Don, my gut tells me that he did take his own life. But I've got to tell you, there's always this other piece that makes me a little uneasy. So it's almost like everybody's where you are in terms of it appears so, but there's a but. So again, so many reasons to tune in on April the 25th. Hey, Justin, talk a little bit about so many of our buds have moved from the Sun, coming over to the Banner from, Pam Wood to Liz Bowie, got a whole crowd coming over there. How tough of a decision was it? I mean, you were a Sun guy. You grew up there. You cut your teeth there. And now you're on to this exciting new venture. Talk to our listeners about the process of ending up at the Banner.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up in Anne Arundel County. I've worked at the Sun. It's the only place I've ever worked. I've spent almost 17 years there, but I'm really excited to be building something here. You know, I joined the Sun when it had over 300 reporters. It now is about 60. You know, the Banner's starting out with a small number, but we're going to be growing. And, this all grew out of the Save Our Sun effort, which was a group of reporters led by Liz Bowie, who you mentioned, trying to get new ownership, trying to do a nonprofit model for journalism. You know, this has been this slow decline of not just the Sun, but all media, really. Local media is struggling. And, you know, there's a chance to rethink it. And so the people that were behind Save Our Sun are now behind this effort. And it's a new model from top to bottom. And I think it's a great chance to do different. We're rethinking how we cover things. Why do we cover things? What do we cover? You know, we have a lot of conversations about what is a Banner story, because we're going to try to be different from the Sun. We don't want to be, even though, yes, I spent a lot of time there and some of my colleagues have come over, and we haven't hired everybody. It's important for them that it's not seen as the Sun 2.0, because we're trying to do something different. At the same time, it's important to have people who know what they're doing, who know their way around town, who have sources, who have context and history. So we're trying to balance all that and bring a new vision to journalism. We started a newsletter. We put out two newsletters so far. Again, we're not going to do it all the time, because we have a long view of trying to get some really impactful journalism for the launch in a few months. But, you know, Tim Prudente, who came over with me, he did a story about problems at the medical examiner's office. He found a secret morgue downtown in a parking garage where they have too many bodies piling up. They can't keep up. And the medical examiner.
It's amazing what government tries to keep secret, right? And Don and I get sideways all the time about, you don't trust it. And I'm thinking, man, if Tim's not down there, you're not down there. If the Sun goes out of business and there's no Ted and there's no Bane, who's doing this in New Orleans? Who's doing this in other places? Investigating government.
You're not suggesting that I don't believe in transparency in government.
And no, I'm
a robust free press, are
you? No. I'm saying there is stench in government and someone needs to investigate it. And not just there's nothing there to see. I mean, this story of the morgue thing is so, it almost sounds far-fetched. Like dirty cops, yeah. I could sort of see maybe that could happen, but hiding these things, that reporters have to go find these things, or the FBI in, you know, certain cases has to find these things, it really, I shudder at a world without that, literally, if we don't have that.
And that is what, like, you know, we feel a lot of pressure for that reason, because we know there are a lot of things that we should be looking into that maybe decades ago, there was people actively looking into. There's so many areas of government where we didn't show up. We stopped showing up and our presence became foreign. And now we don't get that sort of access anymore. You know, we used to ask for things regularly. We stopped asking. And then when you ask now, they say, what, why should we give you that? And it's like, no, you have to give me that. It's just been a while. And so much of the job is sort of trying to remind people of their obligations and making sure that things continue to be provided. We're not even talking about improving the level of things that are provided, maintaining a status quo, holding the line on things. I had to wait. I mean, not to go off on a rant, but I did a story for the Banner newsletter about the awful fire at the on Stricker Street that cost.
Yeah, I want to talk about that story. Go ahead.
I mean, you know, it was mentioned that there was a previous fire there in 2015 where also four firefighters were injured. So I wanted to get the incident report for that incident. very simple request, something that should take probably 5 minutes, if not, you know, at the end of the business. 16 days to get that report. Had to go up to the city solicitor himself.
Why is that? Is there something? Once that happens, or you think, oh, now they're hiding something. Like the minute you don't get it right away, who's back there scrubbing? And then all of a sudden, the reporter mind in you is like, this is how we find out about Wayne Jenkins, literally, right? I mean, it's one thing that leads to another thing.
I would say, though, that in my experience, though, once I got that report, it really didn't say anything. It's really just this bad attitude among government of just sort of, you know, let's make this difficult. Let's make this difficult and so that it won't even bother asking for it. I took 16 days to get the report. I texted the mayor. I called the city solicitor. I was like, and this is not something that I should be bothering these people at that level about, but these are the day in and day out challenges and why we need to hold the line. You know, the judiciary just changed something to the online court database. And my colleague, Tim, he sent an email out to 20 important people saying, you can't do this. You're supposed to have a meeting where you clear these things. You know, these are the types of things we do that don't make the paper. We don't write an article about it, but it's the fighting that like needs to occur in order to keep things open.
It's so important. And it's so frustrating to some of us who spent a long time in government that transparency does not exist. Hey, Justin, what's the difference so far, do you think, and when you all discuss it, between writing a fully digital product versus a digital and print product? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's often times where things couldn't run at certain lengths because they were being cut for print. And I would say, but we have unlimited space online. Shouldn't we allow it to be longer? Now, the flip side to that is, you know, maybe those restraints are good. Maybe readers don't want a long story and we should be cognizant of that anyway. But I'm excited about the opportunity to sort of like not be constrained by that, not be constrained by the print paper, the demands of the print paper, the deadlines, is this a Sunday story? Is this a Monday story? Just sort of, you know, we're going to think about when's the best time to put it out, period. And what's the best length to put it out, period, and not be constrained by those things. I'm it's sad to not be part of a print paper because I know there are many readers that do get the print paper, especially older residents and things like that who are probably picking up the paper going, I haven't seen Justin's name in a while. Where did he go? They don't know. They don't know that I have a tweet pinned that says I'm going to the Baltimore Banner. But again, we're going to try to educate people on that. We're going to have a marketing campaign when we come out and just remind people we're trying to get the word out as best we can. So,
I want to remind people, please, please be prepared to subscribe to the Baltimore Banner.
I want to talk about that because, Justin, you make a decision to do this fundamentally about where the future of the industry is going. And one of my dear friends, Chuck Kilgore, was one of the printers that was, you know, Delaware'd out a couple of weeks ago. A friend of mine whose father was a printer at the Sun when I worked there in 1986, 87, 88. And where the industry is going and where Stewart's vision is and where MTS Patel and Kimmy and all the people that are in your place trying to build something from scratch. I mean, I don't, other than, you know, I guess the Examiner played this game 15 years ago of saying we're going to start something from nothing with a bad idea. Everything I've heard about this and bringing all of you capable, seasoned people on that makes it attractive to people like me and Don to say, oh, well, you know, they have real reporters there. What about this global decision over the last, not just 6 months, but literally over the last 10 years at the Sun and Save Our Sun and all of those things that we were a part of that ultimately lets you believe this is going to work? What about this makes you believe this works?
I'm really encouraged by the fact that before they started hiring reporters over the past month or so, they had business people with experience at Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones, other places. They've been here for almost a year. They've been laying the groundwork to make sure this is successful. I think one of the things that they've said is that there's some startups in other cities, other places where a bunch of journalists say, you know what? The business people are terrible. The penny pinchers and the hedge funds and all these things, we need to get out from under that. Let's start our own publication. And they have good intentions, but they don't know what they're doing as far as a business side. These folks have had smart business people in place for some time, and they're laying things out that are going to, I think, really enable us to be successful. We're going to have a clean, functional website. We're going to have reliable billing and delivery. I mean, things like that, that like, I think that people have come to be frustrated with, you know, legacy outlets from, and we're going to be a nonprofit. You know, we have a different view on this, the whole approach, the nonprofit approach, I think is also going to cause us to look at things differently.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, Stuart Bainham, who's funding this in large part, he's made a commitment and, is a little bit scary. Sure. It's a new thing. I don't know. I started to question whether Baltimore could sustain one main outlet, let alone two. I mean, so there's risk for sure. But I think that's on us now. The business people are setting things up, and it's on us journalists to now do great journalism.
Well, we certainly plan to do our part to promote the banner and get people to pay attention. Justin, it may have been your last article or close to your last article for the Baltimore Sun, had to do with the food project. And I was struck because I thought it was such a Justin Fenton opening sentence. And I can still recall the sentence. It's the first time Troy, and I forget Troy's last name.
Rush, Troy Rush. Yep.
Troy Rush was shot. And I thought, I remember watching the Hemingway documentary, and Hemingway is quoted as saying, start each day by trying to write one perfect sentence. If you can write one perfect sentence, then you can build. And I thought, the first time Troy Rush was shot. And then you describe him running toward this place called the Food Project. I thought, was that your last article for the Sun?
It was, and I'm very proud it was my last article for the Sun.
Oh, it's tell folks about the Food Project and Troy, because I was moved by it.
Carol, the Food Project is a program for youth, older youth, teenagers, young men and women in the Carrollton Ridge neighborhood of Southwest Baltimore. And that's a neighborhood that is, quite frankly, like haunted me for some time. It is perhaps the most challenged neighborhood in Baltimore. Incredible amount of vacancy. Lots of open air drug dealing and using, lots of fires, lots of gun violence. And, I came to the story last summer because a source told me that one of the teenagers who had beaten up Ricky Spector, the city councilwoman who was carjacked and beaten up, that he'd been charged with a murder. And basically, I thought, I went back to the coverage of that case. Ms. Spector had really tried to help that young man and the other person who had also attacked her. She wanted to help them. She didn't want them to go to jail. She wanted them to get support. And I thought, well, what happened? If he was set up with this program, how did that happen? And the story was going to be basically about a young man who committed a horrible crime after getting a second chance after committing a previous horrible crime. And as I started talking to her and the people at the Food Project, they said, you've got it all wrong, which usually for me is, I said, no, I'll tell the story. You don't tell me how to write this story. I'm going to evaluate this and tell the story that I think is there. But they really did a great job of convincing me that this program lacks resources. And this is a program. Carrollton Ridge has had 30 homicides over the past 2 years. That is far and away more than any other city neighborhood. And this is one of the only programs is trying to help people in that area. And they don't have any funding. So what they said was, every time a young person gets shot, they have the budget to help maybe 12 people at a time there, a drop in the bucket. But when something tragic happens, all of a sudden 40 people show up at the door saying, we want to get out of this kind of lifestyle. We want support. We want to help our families. And they don't have the money for it. The city made available $50 million in funding from COVID relief for anti-violence. But they applied for money and couldn't get any. They were told, you're not an anti-violence program. That's what, there's more other organizations that more acutely work on anti-violence, but they're saying getting people jobs, giving them somewhere to go, that's anti-violence. That's keeping them out of trouble. So my last crime story for the Sun didn't quote police at all. It wasn't a police story. It's about a community that believes they have an answer to the problem and they need help. And so I was hoping that by getting the word out that would get them some help. I'm doing a book event that's sold out, so I'm not advertising it, but at Monument City Brewing on Saturday, and they're going to donate. They asked me, we want to donate some of the proceeds of the event from beer sales and otherwise.
What if I'm thirsty, man? Come on.
they're going to donate the proceeds to the Food Project. So, and I want to continue. I think it's set up me up well for the transition because I want to do more stories like that talk about what are some of the people who have solutions? How can we help them? And how can we be more positive?
Well, the solution part of it, right, is part of like the journalism part. We're like, I don't provide solutions. I tell stories, right? And then, but you've moved. This has moved you in a different way, right? Is this part of the reporting you've done and seeing all of this carnage as a part of it that you feel like that maybe the journalism pen can become a solution tool?
I think you're right in that I am afraid to advocate solutions because I don't think I have. If I had the solutions, I might, you know, I could, you know, I think these are very challenging problems. And I think offering solutions can be risky for a journalist. But at the same time, I think we want to do more solutions-based journalism here, highlighting things that work, highlighting things that people believe will work, and trying to put that to the test and do more of. It's very easy. The city has a lot of challenges, and it's very easy to say, look at all the things that are screwed up. And I want to say, look at something that's screwed up, but maybe also, and here's one way that we might be able to fix it. So I think you're going to see more of that type of journalism at the Banner.
I'm getting crab cake with him. That's it.
And he's it's so fitting. It cuts right to the core of Baltimore Positive and what you're going to see on the Banner. Again, that article on the food project, I would encourage everyone, go out, Google it, Justin Fenton, food project. It ends with a banner hangs in the interior of the building where Dorsey and others are working to open the food project's restaurant and business incubator, grinding two times as hard in honor of Troy Rush Jr. It's about as positive as it gets. Check it out, folks. Justin, good luck on the HBO series. Good luck at the Baltimore Banner. And we look forward to having you back on soon.
All right. Thank you so much, guys.
Hey, dude, I'm going to be following you on Twitter. And whenever you get into that suite and they give you the champagne, and I mean, you have to sit for 6 hours and watch your own thing, right? So I don't know if you're going to do that all in one sitting or how it's going to go. But I definitely want you tweeting about your excitement level because I think we're excited about watching it.
Yeah, I hope to do some like behind the scenes tweets, little nuggets of, fun facts about things from the making of the show.
Tell Simon, I've got that Maledict, the book. It's in paperback. He's going to love it. All right. He's going to love it. Believe me. I love reading it in his voice. Justin Fenton here of the Baltimore Banner. We're having more Banner folks on, the former Sun folks on. We are getting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road. We're coming to Canton at Mama's on the Half Shell, and Nacho Mama's having the Scunny Crab Cake. That'll happen on Friday the 4th to honor my father's birthday's March 5th. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. We'll be letting ourselves play and getting it back out. All of our Wise Conversations also brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets, and we're very appreciative of their sponsorship as well. Don, what a Banner week we're having around here, huh?
Doesn't get any better than this. I will have the popcorn on April the 25th.
There you go. All right. Well, ice down the drinks. I'll be over in Catonsville in the 21228. I am Nestor. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, we are WNST AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.